Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Wednesday the 13th of June. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Tom Morgan. Tonight on the show, we speak to Professor Martin Holt about his paper, Community Level Changes in Condom Use and Uptake of HIV Pre-Exposure Prophylaxis by Gay and Bisexual Men in Melbourne and Sydney, and find out if we are getting the whole picture from mainstream media. Is condom use in the decline? Or are we just taking our sexual health into our own hands with the introduction of PrEP on the PBS? Plus, ever wondered what it takes to be a sperm donor? Well, maybe it's time you found out, because Australia is suffering from a sperm drought and our community shares some of the blame.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
Why is the rest of the world so obsessed with the sex lives of Australian gay and bisexual men? A paper published in The Lancet last week titled Community Level Changes in Condom Use and Uptake of HIV Pre-Exposure Prophylaxis by Gay and Bisexual Men in Melbourne and Sydney, Australia, highlighted, amongst other things, an increase in PrEP use to protect against HIV, but a decline in condom use for men who are not taking the HIV prevention drug. Ian Muchmore speaks to Professor Martin Holt at the Centre for Social Research and Health at the University of New South Wales, now on The Informer, to find out about the data and make sure we're getting the whole picture.
What is so fascinating for the rest of the world about the sex lives of Australian gay and bisexual men?
Well, yes, it is a good question. I mean, as we know, there often sometimes appears to be somewhat prurient interest in the sex lives of gay and bisexual men. Obviously, gay and bisexual men in Australia, like in some other countries, are the population that is most affected by HIV. I guess the interest is because Melbourne and Sydney and Victoria and New South Wales more broadly have embarked on a very grand experiment to bring PrEP to a large number of gay and bisexual men in both jurisdictions. And we've seen, you know, very rapid uptake in PrEP. And our study looks at that uptake, but it also looks at the sexual practices of other gay and bisexual men, so men who may not be using PrEP themselves. And what's interesting about that is we see this really lovely and positive embracing of PrEP by gay men who were at risk of HIV but now, of course, are successfully protected from it. And that's shown really nicely in the results that we've got, which are drawn from the Melbourne and Sydney gay community periodic surveys, which many of your listeners will be familiar with. But at the same time, it also shows that consistent condom use among other men has also fallen a bit. Now, condom use remains the primary strategy for gay and bisexual men having casual sex. It has been the primary strategy for a really long time. But we also know that consistent condom use has declined a bit over time because gay men have found other ways to protect themselves from HIV, and whether that be attention to HIV status or increasingly knowledge of undetectable viral load and now PrEP. And I guess the message from our research is generating attention is we're both saying, well, look, we're showing the successful rollout of PrEP at scale. And that's unusual internationally. Most countries have been a bit more reticent about promoting PrEP, even though we know it's really effective. But at the same time, it also shows a disruptive effect on condom use at a community level. And obviously, we have to pay really close attention to that, because ideally, we would like to increase PrEP use as much as we can for people who appear to be at high risk of HIV, because they will no longer be at risk. But we'd also like to sustain condom use and other protective measures in the population to get the biggest bang for our buck. And, you know, Australia is committed to trying to get HIV on an elimination pathway. And we've seen some really promising signs for guys on PrEP in New South Wales and Victoria, where, you know, so it's working incredibly well. And we've seen really promising reductions in diagnoses because of PrEP, but among other people, we're not seeing those declines, and a concern is less consistent condom use in the rest of the population will undo those positive changes.
Let's not overwhelm people with the science, but can we break it down? So you're saying that you're seeing an increase, a big increase in the number of people taking PrEP in the last 2 or 3 years, accompanied by an equally rapid decrease in consistent condom use. Isn't this just what you would expect, that many, many more men are taking PrEP and they wouldn't you be comfortable that they're less likely to use condoms?
Yes, so I think the distinction that may be lost slightly is most guys who've gone on PrEP were already not consistently using condoms before. That's what made them eligible for PrEP in the first place or interested in it. What we're also seeing is a decline in consistent condom use among other men. So the surveys are at a community level. And so that's the concerning thing. You know, why are we seeing declines in condom use by guys who are not on PrEP themselves? And I think that's a conversation we need to have in the communities. You know, we're still at a really early stage of PrEP rollout. If you think about it, we've only just got the public listing on the pharmaceutical benefits scheme. We don't even think that we're anywhere near kind of saturation coverage of PrEP for people who might benefit from it and people who are interested in it. So I think now is really the time when we're trying to encourage people to be aware that PrEP is available through the public system. There are many guys who, you know, may be periodically at risk of HIV because they don't consistently use condoms with their partners, and we'd really like them to consider PrEP now. The question, I guess, at an epidemiological level, which is, you know, will we continue to see declining HIV notifications in jurisdictions that roll out PrEP, is we don't want to see condom use fall too fast among guys who are not on PrEP. We don't expect everybody will want to go on PrEP. It may not be for everyone. But we know from the last couple of years that, you know, many parts of the country, like so out of Victoria and New South Wales, have had relatively low levels of access to PrEP, and we actually are expecting levels of PrEP use to increase around the country, which we're hoping will have a national impact on the HIV epidemic.
Is this about education, or is it that some gay and bisexual men are ignorant or complacent or irresponsible? We see all sorts of language bandied around in the media.
Yes, and that language is really depressing and kind of unhelpful. If you think about, I've never seen any research that has indicated that gay men are complacent or don't care about HIV. Like, in fact, the engagement with PrEP in the last 2 years really, and, you know, the accounts of men who come out of those studies showed, you know, this profound, you know, that men were really concerned about PrEP, about HIV, and then going on PrEP, they've experienced profound relief from fear of infection. And so that's one of the really amazing things it offers. And recklessness, you know, some critical commentators might point at that, go, well, why are we seeing this declining condom use? Well, within that, you'll have some guys who are actually actually having sex with guys on PrEP or men with undetectable viral load. So that interaction is safe. But we would also prefer those guys themselves, if they're doing that a lot, we would prefer that they were themselves protected by using PrEP. And I have a question about, like, other guys where perhaps they're not sure about the status of their partners or whether their partners are taking PrEP or whether they're on treatment or not. In those situations, we really still want men to use condoms if they're not certain about the status of their partner or whether their partner's on PrEP or has got viral suppression. And the survey data, it masks a bit of that, but, you know, in there, that is our concern, that norm of using condoms every time has changed, because obviously more guys are aware now that there are a range of options that they can choose from. However, we do want every gay man who's sexually active to choose a strategy that works for them and not just hope that other people are doing the right thing or that sex in general has got safer because they're aware other people are using PrEP. You know, we want everybody to play their part.
Do you think that there's a group of gay men or bisexual men and they're HIV negative, or maybe they're not sure, they're not taking PrEP and they're sort of taking it for granted that someone else is making the risk reduction strategies for them?
We don't know that for sure. There is a bit of qualitative research evidence from, you know, interviews with guys on PrEP who are saying they're coming across situations where they sort of suspect they're being sought out as partners. Prevention by proxy, you might call it, you know, where, like, they're sexual partners are aware that if they have condomless sex, it's going to be safe for them, but they're not on PrEP themselves. I'm not sure at a community level that we're clear about that. It may just be that this in the early stage of rollout, you know, that practices are a bit disrupted. Some of the other areas where there is concern are among, you know, recent migrants who've arrived in Australia who may know less about HIV and sexual health and prevention practices. Medicare ineligible people, also perhaps from who've recently arrived from overseas. And there are some, yes, structural questions there about, even if they're aware of PrEP, they may not know how they can access it. And I think those need to be addressed. In terms of awareness and knowledge, like, I mean, the surveys, the same surveys on which the Lancet HIV paper is based, show very rapid increase in awareness of PrEP among gay and bisexual men in Melbourne and Sydney especially. I mean, pretty much everybody has heard of it now. So I'm not sure it's awareness. Maybe knowledge, when we've looked at that, can be a bit patchy. People might not quite understand what it entails, that, you know, when it was first rolled out in Australia in the last few years, it involved, you know, we were recommending that people take a pill every day, and that's what the majority of guys using PrEP are doing at the moment. I mean, recently a new option has been endorsed by doctors in Australia, HIV doctors, who've said, you know, that event-based dosing may work better for people who are not sexually active on a regular basis. And to summarise that as simply as I can, that's based on a big European study that was done that found that, you know, if you take two pills a few hours before you have sex, and then you take a pill the next day and a pill the day after around the sexual event, that is as effective as daily dosing in preventing HIV. And so recently the experts in the clinical domain have endorsed that as a particular option. And I think that's kind of an interesting one, because that might encourage more engagement for men who might have concerns about taking medication every day or concerns about side effects. I mean, the studies seem to be showing that side effects are relatively minimal, and they're fairly temporary for people who start on PrEP. But, you know, it's understandable. Some people might go, I'm not sure I want to take medication every day. In that situation, if they're still interested, though, I would encourage that they talk to their GP or a specialist at a sexual health clinic about their options.
That was Ian Muchamore with Professor Martin Holt at the Centre for Social Research and Health at the University of New South Wales.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
Have you ever thought about becoming a sperm donor? Ever wondered what it takes? Seriously. There's a reason I'm asking. It's because Australia is in a sperm shortage and our communities are to blame. Dean Arcuri finds out more as he speaks to Dr. Weston from the Monash IVF Group.
Australia, we've got a sperm problem. We're running out of sperm. That's right, it's a sperm shortage down under. But how, I hear you say? Well, our LGBTIQ communities are partly responsible. So what are we going to do about it? I sat down with Dr. Weston from Monash IVF Group to find out. Dr. Weston was the first gay IVF specialist in Victoria to open up a private practice and is a leading gay rights doctor at Monash IVF.
Traditional people who need sperm donors are heterosexual couples where the male partner doesn't have any sperm in his ejaculate and we're unable to find any sperm for him. Although they're traditionally the main group that require sperm donors, they're actually now our smallest group. In Victoria, from 2010, both single women, lesbian couples, transgender patients, any patient who wants to have a child can access donor sperm treatment. As a result of that, our sperm stocks have gone to an all-time low because 75 to 80% of access to the donor sperm bank is now from non-heterosexual couples or from single patients. There's probably been a slight decrease in the number of men who've donated, but we've had a quadrupling in the demand on the donor sperm bank, and we very much want to be able to meet the needs of all of our patients, single, straight, lesbian, transgender, gay. If we're going to meet those needs, we need more sperm donors.
Sperm donation is a reality for many in our communities who want to start a family, not simply because many of us are in same-sex relationships, but because sperm donation is also a way in which people are able to conceive in today's day and age for a variety of reasons. But if we don't have enough sperm, then couples will need to look elsewhere.
Sperm donation has the capacity to completely transform lives. I mean, not just sperm donation, but egg donation. Any situation where a couple lack one of the basic components to make a child, you just cannot imagine how it transforms their lives when they have that little child in their arms. I've seen single women's lives transformed. I've seen lesbian couples who've had families brought together as a result of having a child together. I've seen just the most amazing transformations of people's lives. And if we have enough donor sperm to be able to meet all those needs, then we can continue to help the community to have children, because we've fought very long and hard to have the right to have children, and that's wonderful. We have the right to, but we need the sperm.
So you might be thinking, is this something I can help with? What kind of sperm are we talking about here? Well, the reality is, lots. Just like our communities, the sperm needed should be just as diverse.
The fact that we have such a small number of donors coming through now means that single women and our lesbian couples in particular, as two of our largest groups, have a limited choice of sperm donors. And you've got to realise that we're not just dealing with sexual orientation here, we also are dealing with a very diverse cultural group. It's not enough for us just to have Caucasian sperm donors on file. We have to have Indian donors, Asian donors, African donors, Greek, Italian, any ethnic group you can think of is definitely going to be used. And if we don't have a diverse group of sperm donors, then we can't meet the needs of all of our patients.
So wait, are we talking about a need for just a lot of sperm, or is it specific sperm, or sperm from different cultures? What kind of sperm are we talking about here?
All sperm in general, but also specific ethnicities. So if we will accept sperm donors of any colour, creed, race, education level. The only limits we have is with regards to age. We do require our sperm donors to be over 21 and to be under 45 years of age, because we have consent issues for people under the age of 21. We think it may be a little too young. And if we have sperm donors that are in the older age group, we do have an increase in miscarriages and other genetic problems for the children.
Some of you, like myself, might only really know about sperm donation from what you've seen in a movie. But it's no laughing matter. The people who donate sperm help others to make their families. So what does it take to become a sperm donor?
If somebody's going to come forward and be a sperm donor, it is a significant commitment. We need to assess that donor to make sure that they don't carry any genetic diseases that could be passed on to the children. And we also need to assess them for any sexually transmitted infections that could be passed on to the people receiving the donor sperm. We do take a careful history, and we do a number of blood tests on the potential donors, and we also need to assess their sperm, obviously, to make sure that the sperm is of a reasonable quality. Even if it is not of top quality, we will still accept it, because we can use it for IVF, even if we can't use it for artificial insemination. We need to be able to ensure that they can adequately consent, no mental health issues, that sort of thing, that preclude consent. And that's about it, really. And then they need to be willing to come in and provide us with a number of sperm samples, because we'll get a number of ejaculates and store up enough sperm to be able to meet the needs of up to 10 women who can be treated with that donor sperm.
Okay, so when we're talking about being a sperm donor, it's more than just ejaculating into a cup. How much sperm is it that you actually need?
Well, it depends on the quality of the sperm. So we may find that we only need a few ejaculates, and then we get a large number of vials of sperm, because the concentration of sperm and the quality of sperm is high enough that we need less ejaculates. In other cases, we need a larger number of ejaculates if the sperm count is lower or the quality of the sperm is poorer.
Would you like to do your bit to become a sperm donor? You can find out more information at australianneedsyoursperm.com.au and help rainbow families grow.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Australia is in a sperm shortage, and it's not going to donate itself. Now on The Informer, Dean Arcuri continues his conversation with Dr. Weston from the Monash IVF Group, as we find out more about Australia's sperm shortage and what you can do to contribute.
Australia is close to a sperm drought, and our communities are part of the reason why. But that doesn't mean you can't do your bit to help make more rainbow families a reality. I'm speaking with Dr. Weston from Monash IVF, who was the first gay IVF specialist in Victoria to open up a private practice. We're talking about what it takes to become a sperm donor. It's not as simple as you think, and it's not just about some sperm in a turkey baster. There's more to it, like a different expectation from a clinic donor to a known donor.
Let's say a lesbian couple are coming to see me, and as they frequently do, and they are coming to start a family together. The first thing we need to establish is, where are we going to get the sperm from? Some of these women come forward and they have a friend or a relative or somebody that they know that they're bringing themselves to be their donor. And that person goes through the same vetting process that a clinic recruited donor goes through. But when the sperm is released from quarantine, it's only going to be used by the woman who's recruited her own known donor. That sperm is stored solely for the use of the couple who have recruited that donor for themselves. That's a known donor. A clinic recruited donor is of more value for us because that donor can be used for up to 10 women rather than just for the individual couple. So we then recruit that donor and go through the registration and vetting process ourselves. And then the women come to us and they say, look, we don't actually want to have someone we know as the sperm donor. We'd like somebody with a bit of distance. Do you have any sperm donors on file? And in fact, 80% of our lesbian couples and 95% of our single women prefer a donor who's been recruited by the clinic rather than them having to go out and ask a chap to be their known donor.
If I donate sperm today, what about the future? Could someone knock on my door in 18 years' time and tell me that they're my child? What information do they get about me?
The recipients would have nothing that would enable them to actually identify you on the street. So they could be sitting next to you in a tram and they wouldn't know that you had actually been their sperm donor. We certainly do not give any details with regards to your address, your phone number, or any photos of what you look like now. We may ask for a photo of when you were a child. They will know your height, weight, hair colour, eye colour, your ethnicity, your level of education, your blood group, skin tone. They'll want to know a little bit about your occupation and your interests. And it's surprising how important it is for the women when they're selecting, getting a bit of a feel for the personality of the person who's going to be their sperm donor. And it's really important that we have that information because, for example, if you are a Caucasian couple, you may or may not be interested in an African donor. And vice versa, and an African couple may not want Caucasian sperm. And height is really important because if I've got a very small woman, she may not want the biggest sperm donor because she's actually got to deliver the baby after 9 months. There's a huge amount that goes into their thought processes and they agonise over the decision-making process with the information that we're able to provide them, but it's all non-identifying. It doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, where you come from, what's your race, there's going to be someone who's going to be interested in your sperm because you are going to meet their particular requirements.
Donating sperm to help someone else start a family is a lovely thing to do, but it's important that you understand your rights and responsibilities so that everyone's on the same page.
Well, there's absolutely no way a donor-conceived child can access your estate. That's one thing that some of our donors are concerned about, that somehow they're going to have a donor-conceived child come out and demand a piece of their estate. There is no legal mechanism by which that can occur. There's also no legal mechanism whereby parents of a donor-conceived child can sue the donor for any maintenance. So you are completely unencumbered by any financial responsibilities. The donor-conceived child can seek information about you as a donor, your name, your address, and can seek contact, which usually occurs through the social workers of the department. The donor is allowed to say no. So if you have donated and in 18 years' time, when the child reaches 18 years of age, you do have the right of refusal to say, look, I do not want to meet the child. Although in our experience, very few donors would say no, but you do have that right. And you as a donor have the right to seek contact with a donor-conceived child from your sperm. And the child on reaching 18 does also, in the same direction, have the right to say no.
We're running out of sperm, Australia, and it's time to drop trowel and do your bit.
We have got an increasingly diverse society. We need to meet the needs of people of every sort of ethnicity, race and religion you can think of. But the other issue is really the success of the gay and lesbian community in asserting their rights to have children has been a story of remarkable success. But it has come at a cost to our donor sperm bank. But what I don't want is the situation where I have a lesbian couple coming to see me to say, look, we're ready, we've married, we're ready to have children, we're ready to start, where's the sperm? And then I have to say to them, well, we don't have any. Mm. And that's the real situation that we're going to be facing in the near future. These women are going to have to go around and find their own sperm. And I just think that that would be a terrible shame if we couldn't meet the needs of these women.
As our equal rights grow, so does our need to provide for them. And helping to do your bit for the creation of rainbow families is actually really simple.
I was the first gay IVF specialist in Victoria to open up in private practice. And in the last 8 years, 9 years, I've seen a huge explosion in the number of couples coming to seek help. Look, a lot of people do just home insemination, but that doesn't work for everyone. And a lot of lesbians are like everyone else. Often they'll find a partner later in life at a time when their fertility is not at its peak. And they'll need help, and they will need donor sperm, and we are really struggling.
You can find out more information by phoning 1800 731 927 or heading to australianeedyoursperm.com.au.
That was Dean Arcuri with Dr. Weston from the Monash IVF Group discussing Australia's sperm shortage.
This is The Informer on Joy
94.9. That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing you news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. A podcast of tonight's show will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au. You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. I'm Tom Morgan.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9.